Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the wake of the water contamination crisis in Flint, Michigan, many people across the country are wondering if their water is safe. There has been a lot of media attention on the country's aging water infrastructure. Millions of miles of lead service pipes connect water mains to people's homes. Earlier this year, an investigation by The Guardian found that there is a lot of cause for concern. The majority of cities east of the Mississippi River are underreporting the amounts of lead and copper in municipal water systems. Cities like Detroit and Philadelphia are using inaccurate water testing methods to conceal high levels of lead in their drinking water. Roughly 96 million people could be drinking water with unsafe levels of lead, according to the American Water Works Association. In fact, just in the last couple of weeks, officials in Texas, Petersburg, New York, Sebring, Ohio, Jackson, Mississippi, and Newark, New Jersey have warned residents about high levels of lead, arsenic, and PFOA in tap water. PFOA is the chemical that's used to make Teflon, and we did a show about DuPont a couple of weeks ago, which you can find at yourcallradio.org. So what explains this? Why in 2016 should we still be concerned about chemicals in our drinking water? How is the EPA, which is responsible for ensuring the safety of drinking water, enforcing the 40-year-old Safe Drinking Water Act? And how much does this have to do with budget cuts? Today we are joined by Paul Swartz, Clean Water Action's National Policy Coordinator. That's an organization that advocates water sustainability and new approaches to water management. Paul is also Clean Water Fund's Water Policy Director, and he sits on the steering committee of the Campaign for Safe and Affordable Drinking Water. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined by Emily Worth. She is Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director. Emily conducts research and promotes policies to help protect the nation's water systems as public assets and to safeguard the country's water resources. Hi, Emily. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, Paul, we did a show a couple of weeks ago about the water crisis in Flint, and according to reports, about 100,000 Flint residents are still drinking bottled water. Why is it taking so long to get the residents of Flint clean water through their pipes?
Well, that's a really great question, and there's still concern as well about the drinking water with bathing and showering and what the baselines are for a variety of contaminants in the drinking water. Residents there really are not trusting the conclusions that are being drawn by federal, state, and local authorities about the safety of their water in almost any case right now. I think the reason why this is all proving to be so difficult is that the trust with the public right now, unfortunately, has been broken. And folks in Flint and in some other places in the country are not taking assurances sitting down. So I think this is the basis of the problem. Meanwhile, the governor and the mayor in Flint and the water authority are going through painstaking efforts to get to the point where that trust can be repaired and to really make sure that the public health is served. It's just such a deep betrayal that people having been threatened at the core for their public health are not trusting of the pronouncements that are being made.
We're hearing a lot about lead pipes, and a group in January filed a lawsuit calling on Flint, Michigan to replace all the lead pipes in its water system. And a lot of residents are saying that they will not drink the water until the pipes are replaced. What does it actually mean to replace lead pipes? What do you replace them with?
Well, right now, they're considering a number of options in Flint. One option is to replace all of the lead service lines, not just the ones that are lead, because they're uncertain which of the service lines are made of lead or of other material. The second thing is they're looking at potentially an innovative way of dealing with lead service lines that the city of Lansing in Michigan did to replace their lead service lines, which is to insert a plastic sort of balloon that goes through the pipe and that shields the lead from the water. And then the third thing that they're thinking about doing, and they've started doing, is to go in and to replace some of the lead service lines, the lines between the main, the water main in the street and the home, with copper piping or with PVC, polyvinyl chloride piping. And those pipes, if they're done fully, if they're fully replaced, not just the public portion of the line, that will reduce the amount of lead coming into people's homes, although not necessarily solve the lead problem at the tap.
And what it would cost to change the lead service pipes in Flint is estimated to be between $600 and $800 million. And Emily, the American Society of Civil Engineers 2013 report card for the country's infrastructure gave the water infrastructure a D+. And according to some estimates, again from the American Society of Civil Engineers, it would cost about $1 trillion to completely overhaul the country's water infrastructure over the next 25 years. So how much does this have to do with funding?
You know, at Food and Water Watch for years, we've been advocating for increased federal funding of our water and sewer systems that are so essential. What we've seen is since the time that Congress passed essential environmental laws like the Clean Water Act and Safe Drinking Water Act, since that time, you know, when those laws were passed, they came with funding. We've seen this dramatic cutback. It's actually a 74% decrease in real dollars between 1977, which was kind of the peak of our federal funding, to 2014. We've seen a 74% cutback in funding, and that's actually 82% decrease when you do it per person or per capita. And so, you know, that's really having an impact in these cities across the country. What we've seen is systems that were built in the early 20th century are really reaching the end of their lifespan, and we really do need to address this serious problem we have now with you know, lead pipes and lead service lines that serve millions of people nationwide. I think there's more than 7 million I've seen 7 million lead service lines across the country. And so that's why we've been advocating for something that we've called a water trust fund, a dedicated source of funding. Right now, funding for water and sewer systems is appropriated by Congress. And so it kind of really depends on the political whims of the time. And what we've seen, like I said, in recent times is that there's been less and less money, with the exception of the stimulus package under the Obama administration, devoted to these water and sewer systems. And so we're advocating for a trust fund that would be a dedicated source of funding that would begin to fill this huge need that we have, and would be something that could be counted on year after year, because a lot of these projects that need to be conducted are multi-year projects. And so water and sewer utilities need to know that that funding can actually come in for those projects to happen.
Yeah, I was just checking out the National Priorities Project pie chart of the budget, because President Obama just announced his budget recently. So yeah. Under what subject line does water funding fall?
Well, the water is allocated through the state revolving fund program that's administered out of the Environmental Protection Agency. And there's a clean water, which is essentially sewers, and there's a drinking water program. And so that's how funding has been appropriated for water and sewer systems for years. And so, you know, having this dedicated source of funding would just, dramatically increase the amount of money that's allocated through that existing state revolving fund program administered by the EPA.
Paul, can you tell us more about this 74 to 82% decrease in funding we have seen since 1977? What explains this?
Well, there's a number of factors that are in play in terms of the funding. The thing to know is that about 90 cents out of each dollar for water infrastructure funding that's currently flowing in the United States is from local tax dollars and people's rates for water and sewage. And when we look at the overall funding gap between the funding flows that we have now and what's needed, in addition to the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Funds, which are funds that are actually fairly large and substantial in a number of states, where money is matched between the federal, funds and some state 20% matches. There's also very large funds for low-income and rural clean water and drinking water projects that flow through the Department of Agriculture, about $1 billion through the Rural Utility Service each year. And there's an ability on the part of communities to leverage funds on the municipal bond market. That all being said, none of this money is free. The federal tax dollars, the state matches, the money that's gotten through the bond market, all has to be borne by the ratepayer. And so what we're seeing is with an emphasis on cleaning up our lakes, rivers, and streams, with an emphasis on dealing with planetary pollution like nutrient loadings in the oceans and in our lakes and rivers and streams, and with old historic problems such as the lead service lines, there are billions of dollars that are being put on the table at the community level through regulation and through what are called consent decrees or judges ruling on Clean Water Act and Safe Drinking Water Act violations. And communities are having a really hard time coming up with the funding, especially those communities that have a lot of low-income people and are disproportionately communities of color. And so this burden is something that needs support at all levels of government, from federal share to state share to local, unfortunately, to local rate increases.
Emily, what does Food and Water Watch's number crunching tell us? Because the American Society of Civil Engineers says it'll take $1 trillion to complete a complete overhaul of the country's water infrastructure, whereas the EPA says it would take about $330 billion.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of different estimates out there. I mean, we've heard that, you know, EPA has estimated that each year we fall $22 billion short of what's needed. So I think, we like to think of this is an ongoing issue. This isn't like a one-time fix where you just make a big investment and then everything's going to be fine. You know, this is something that we think we need, a dedicated source of funding, because these are investments that we're going to have to make, you know, from here on out to maintain our systems and to upgrade them and to address, you know, all of the issues and the upgrades. And, you know, as you add regulations of other new emerging contaminants and things like that need to be detected and responded to appropriately, it takes funding to make that happen. And so, you know, we don't support placing mandates on systems without having the funding that makes it possible for them to provide those essential services. And so the number we've typically used is $22 billion each year.
$22 billion a year. That is Emily Wirth. She is Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director. We're also joined by Paul Schwartz, Clean Water Action's National Policy Coordinator. And today we are talking about water safety in the United States. A couple weeks ago, we did a show about the root causes of the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. And we wanted to take a look at the country overall, because there are a lot of problems right now. In fact, in the last couple of weeks, you had officials in New York, Pennsylvania, and Texas saying that there are high levels of lead, arsenic, and PFOA in the water. So it's not just lead. So what questions do you have about drinking water? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What about that, Paul? Lead is getting most of the attention, but we've got officials now warning residents about high levels of arsenic and also PFOA in tap water. And PFOA is the chemical that's used to make Teflon.
Mm-hmm. Well, the issue is that for most water systems and for most people, the drinking water is pretty safe. But just like when we get out in cars and we know that there's carnage across the highways from bad design in automobiles, from bad behavior of drivers, from bad road design, and we're working to reduce all of those problems, we know that there are a number of problems in water systems across the country, both from our industrial legacy and from naturally occurring contaminants. The problem that we have right now is that the Safe Drinking Water Act, which is the major law that governs the quality of water and health protections coming out of our tap, is being very weakly enforced. The water utility community, it has a variable level of accountability and transparency for the work they're doing, and our industrial polluters, and that's not the problem with lead in our water systems, but our industrial polluters are increasingly being exempted, and regulations are being weakened in a number of places, like in fracking for natural gas. So we do face a variety of issues that come from different threat places. You know, so arsenic can be naturally occurring in the soils, and as we pump out groundwater from aquifers at a higher rate, we release more of those metals into the drinking water. And it's just a pretty complex set of threats, and really what I suggest is that people understand what the likely contaminants are in their communities and make sure that working with their drinking water providers, the water utilities, that they make sure that those water utilities are doing the best they can in monitoring for these threats and in removal of the threats. And most importantly, upstream, work to hold industrial polluters accountable.
And
lead is a different animal.
How do you go about doing that? Because The Guardian had two damning reports in the last few months. U.S. authorities distorting tests to downplay lead content of water. The other one, water utilities serving American cities use tests to downplay contamination. The Guardian reports that water utilities in some of the largest cities that serve 12 million people have used tests that downplay the amount of lead contamination found in drinking water for more than a decade.
That's absolutely right, and next Monday I'll be testifying in front of the Philadelphia City Council on the question of whether the Philadelphia Water Department, or PWD, is doing just that, gaining the pool of samples that they take, and over the years, instead of testing homes with the worst-case scenario for lead, going to places that are likely not, homes that are likely not to have lead in them, and also instructing people who sample lead in their homes for these pools, these sampling pools, to do things like running the water before taking a test, which makes you miss the lead. We know that this type of practice is happening in utilities across the country, and we're hoping that US EPA, working with residents, will put a stop to this. And we have some indication that because of the focus on the problems in Flint, this might happen in a few places. We really need people in their communities to work with us to demand accurate and independent testing, and to work at the utility level to gain transparency in the testing protocols and procedures, and in understanding what the level of threats are for pregnant women, for women with developing fetuses, and for infants who are fed with reformulated formula. The risk from lead and the risk in our system is in systems that meet all federal and state requirements on the face of it, but are still providing enough lead to cause fetal death, miscarriage, spontaneous abortion, and health effects that are not able to be turned around when small amounts of lead hit a developing fetus in a pregnant woman or an infant who's being fed with reformulated formula. Nothing you can do about it. Once you've gotten the exposure, there's lifetime damage to intellect, behavioral issues, and a huge effect that ripples through our communities.
Emily, what is the best way to find out what is in your water? Here in San Francisco, we are often told that we have the cleanest water in the country because it comes from Hetch Hetchy. And I was checking out the San Francisco Water website, and when I looked at the page of contaminants and regulations, it says contaminants that may be present include microbial contaminants such as viruses and bacteria, inorganic contaminants such as metals, pesticides and herbicides, synthetic and volatile organic chemicals, radioactive contaminants. The key word there is may. These contaminants may be present. So what are we supposed to believe when we read this?
Well, a good source, and actually on our website at foodandwaterwatch.org, we have a guide to helping people understand their water quality report. A water quality report comes out every year, and it should be either sent or now, you know, some of them are available online where you can read the report that your water system is required to disclose to you that releases the information about the testing that they've done in their system. And so that's a really good resource so that you can understand more about that. I think, you know, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, what you're reading from, because I haven't seen that site. But I think a really important thing to talk about is how we do need to protect our source waters, right? I think Paul was alluding to that, that the places that are the sources of our drinking water need to be protected so that we, you know, can be most assured of the water that we're drinking, and that includes you know, regulating the essential drinking water laws that, you know, hold corporations and other industries accountable for any pollution that they might cause to water, which then could become our drinking water. And actually, the funding of our water and sewer systems is important, too, because what we know is that when we're not making investments that, you know, you can see problems with, you know, sewer overflows, which can, you know, eventually end up into drinking water sources that become our drinking water. So this is all really related, that we need to enforce regulations on the books and hold polluters accountable for their pollution, whether it's the, you know, agriculture industry or, like Paul alluded to, the oil and gas industry enjoys exemptions from these essential laws. So we need to, you know, we need to close those loopholes, and we need to hold industry accountable. But we also have to take measures to really protect our source waters, which, you know, addresses some of these problems as well. And I do think that San Francisco does have a very, you know, great source of drinking water, as well as many other places, but that's not always the case. And we can see in Flint clearly what happens when, you know, the source of water being used is problematic to begin with.
Can you talk more about the polluters? I was just thinking about a new study that came out from the Environment America showing that Tyson Foods and its subsidiaries released 104 million pounds of pollution to surface waters from 2010 to 2014, nearly seven times the volume of surface water discharges by Exxon during those years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a serious problem, and what we have is lax regulation of these discharges, and that needs to be a priority, because we know, you know, our water systems are, you know, we have to protect what we have here in our water systems, and so yeah, that's a shocking finding. So
today we are talking about the safety of our water. Emily Wirth is Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director. Paul Schwartz is Clean Water Action's National Policy Coordinator. The contamination crisis in Flint has caused a lot of people to wonder if their water is safe. And in recent weeks, officials in Texas, New York, Ohio, Mississippi, and New Jersey have warned residents about high levels of lead, arsenic, and PFOA in tap water. That's the chemical that's used to make Teflon. So what will it take to ensure our water is safe and to increase funding? Because there's been about a 74 to 82% decrease in funding for water infrastructure projects from 1977 to 2014. What questions do you have about water? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. Toll free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post your comment or question on the website, yourcallradio.com. KALW.org, where you will also find links related to today's program. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that at 12 noon, John Perry, Ken Taylor, and this week's edition of Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with investigative journalist Sally Denton about her new book, The Profiteers, Bechdel and the Men Who Built the World. From 1999 to 2013, Bechdel, the world's largest contractor, received $40 billion in contracts from the U.S. government. Denton says despite its anti-regulatory, anti-government worldview, the Bechdel family owes its entire fortune to the U.S. government. The company is located here in San Francisco. So what do you want to know about Bechdel? And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation about the new documentary Trapped, which looks at abortion clinics and abortion doctors who are under attack. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the safety of our water supply. What will it take to ensure that we have clean water for everyone across the country? We're joined by Paul Schwartz, Clean Water Action's National Policy Coordinator, and Emily Wirth, Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director. And if you have any questions about the safety of our water, when you heard about the Flint water crisis, what questions and concerns did that raise for you? If you work on these issues, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And before we get to calls, I wanted to ask you, Paul, what are your thoughts about big water polluters? Because this new study about Tyson dumping more pollution into waterways every year than Exxon got quite a bit of media attention.
Right. So the first thing I want to say is while I worked at Clean Water Action for over 30 years, I now work with a non-governmental organization called Water Alliance. Clean Water Action continues to do great work in many states around the country under the direction of Lynn Thorpe and their water policy team in a variety of ways. Water Alliance is working with a number of professionals across disciplines to change the way we think about and manage water for the health of people and the planet. And really what we're facing on a planetary scale and in the United States is increasing loads of complex water pollution that the infrastructure that was based on 19th and 20th century investments largely is not adequate to, do the job for the 21st century. It's not resilient in the face of climate change. And it's not able to deal with the large amount of pollution that's being pumped into our drinking water sources, our nation's lakes, rivers, and streams, and the underground water or aquifers across the country. The news with Tyson's has been big, but it's not new. We have huge exemptions in our water laws, as Emily alluded to, that are written into the law so that a lot of the pollutants are not even dealt with. And this is true whether it's a corporate agriculture and big chicken in the case of Tyson's, or whether it's historic problems like the use of lead in our drinking water infrastructure. So we really need, as a population, to step back and not just assume that this first world country is doing a bang-up job of protecting the population and questioning the U.S. EPA and the state regulations that are there to protect us, and making sure that, as it said, we trust but verify, that we have vigilance in the face of the lack of funding, in the face of the lack of innovation, and in the face of an incuriosity on the part both of our public health community and of our government regulators about how all of these things work together with pollution that comes from the air we breathe and from the food we eat, and it's embedded in the soils and in the materials that we use to clothe ourselves and in our homes as well. All of these sources are conspiring together to do a rather large test of the chemicals that we're bearing in our body and that the planet has to deal with. So we really need a reset and a rethink in a very fundamental way. And I think Flint, especially for people of color who are bearing a disproportionate amount of these assaults in the workplace and in their communities of water contaminants, really is we can't just see it as a problem that's in Flint. We have to see it as a challenge in each of our communities and rededicate ourselves to asking tough questions and to really getting educated and picking up the tools to defend our families and our communities.
Emily, Food and Water Watch does a lot of work on the privatization of water. And we have an email from Alicia who writes, to what degree is the failure of the EPA in adequately monitoring the safety of tap water going to contribute to the privatization of water, which is happening around the world?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think that the private water companies, you know, make claims that they can do a better job operating systems, and sadly that's just not what the evidence has bore out. We have a number of reports that we've written on our website, foodandwaterwatch.org, on water privatization specifically, that show that when water systems are privatized, that first of all, rates increase, but also that water service declines, and, you know, that it's bad for the environment as well, because when especially when sewer services are involved, because it leads to more sewage overflows and other problems related to pollution. And so, you know, I do think that's a that is a concern. But actually, we just released a report called "The State of Public Water" that showed the opposite trend, and it showed that that, you know, there are more people being served by public water systems than ever before, and that publicly owned utility actually serve 87% of people across the country, and that for-profit companies only about 10% of water systems, most of which serve small communities. And so we're seeing a trend towards more public ownership, and we're seeing a trend of remunicipalization in areas where systems have been privatized, which I think is good evidence of how it's not a good deal for municipalities or ratepayers, and that many communities are going through the measures of actually reclaiming their systems and getting them back under public management and ownership.
And what explains that trend?
Well, I think, you know, there have been a number of failures by the private water industry, and that they're being well documented, and people are educating themselves and coming together and organizing in what they think is going to be best for their communities. I mean, we've worked with communities across the country to keep their systems public, as well as to help them take back public ownership or public management in the case of some contract deals as well. And so I think that's and what our report found as it relates to rates specifically is that it's 59% more expensive to have private water than public water. And this was a rate survey that we did in-house in 2014 of the 500 largest U.S. community water systems. So it was the largest rate survey of its kind. And again, it found that private systems charge 59% more.
Well, thank you for that email, Alicia. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions for Emily Wirth with Food and Water Watch or Paul Schwartz with Clean Water Action about the quality of our drinking water, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And let's go next to Sarah in Honolulu. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show. Hi, is Sarah there?
Yes, sorry.
Hi.
Hi. So I think this is really interesting. I live on an island. I would say that our water source, you know, ultimately probably comes from rain more than groundwater. And so it's a when you live on an island in the middle of the ocean, it's just something to think about. Where do I get my water from? And people seem to have some misguided priorities these days because they are willing to pay, you know, up to $100 a month for a cell phone and up to $5 a gallon for gas, which is still cheaper than the rest of the world. But they will complain about their water bill, but they will buy bottled water for $2 for a liter. And I just think that's interesting because if you're paying those privatized prices for your public water systems, you would complain, but many, many people buy drinking water, bottled water, which they don't know what the source of that is either. And it just seems to me like our priorities are a little mismatched because water is the resource that we need as humans to survive. And so, if we're willing to pay, you know, $2 for a liter of bottled water, why aren't we willing to invest this, you know, I believe the figure was $22 billion, to make sure that we have safe drinking water, potable water in our communities across the United States?
Well, thank you for that. And before we let you go, Emily, Food and Water Watch has done some studies also on bottled water. And according to Business Insider, the cost, you're paying about 300 times more for bottled water than tap water. And most environmental groups say tap water is the best choice.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a Take Back the Tap campaign because we think, you know, these go hand in hand. As, you know, the bottled water industry has done a lot of slick advertising and marketing to, and now it's ubiquitous, right? You can find it everywhere. But like you said, you pay thousands of times more for something that uses far more energy. And just think of the, production of all this plastic, the transport of the bottles, you know, in trucks across the country to get them, you know, taken from point A to point B. And then we end up with these, you know, single-use plastic bottles, more than 75% of which don't get recycled and actually end up littering our oceans, lakes, and streams and landscape. You just see plastic bottles everywhere now as you walk around. And so, you know, we really encourage people to choose tap water over bottled water. And it's, you know, we see affordable water as a basic human right and something that we need to invest in. And that's why we're advocating, you know, for a dedicated source of federal funding for our essential water and sewer systems so that we can end up with water that's safe and affordable for all. You know, we think it's essential that rates are affordable for all people and that everyone has access to safe drinking water.
The Flint mayor declared a state of emergency. President Obama declared a state of emergency in Flint, Michigan. Do you think that Washington politicians are really doing enough to tackle this issue immediately?
Right. Well, the problem that we're facing is that we have water systems that are in a state of real decay. We have regulations that are not being effectively enforced. And we have a problem with people not making a connection to the water sources and water systems that they use on a day-to-day basis. As bridges and roads are collapsing and they're visible, our water systems are in a lot of problems. And at Water Alliance, one of the things that we're really concerned about is that we're using an old industrial water system whose business model is based on selling as much water as they can and accepting as much waste as they can, instead of looking at ways to treat water to fit the needs that we have, to get rid of the old and creaky water systems that are very expensive to take care of and are falling apart all across the country. Look, the real problem is the public's trust in the public water supply is being eroded by the problems of governmental inaction and malfeasance and mendacity, lying to people about the problem they're facing. And in losing confidence, they're turning to a less secure and more expensive water supply and bottled water. We need to make the public water supply and the trust of the public in the water systems a priority at the federal and at the state and at the local level. And whether you get your drinking water from a private company or from a public company, we need to hold them to the highest standards here in the United States and not let our water systems devolve into insecure, unsecure, and troubling sources of what's one of the most important things that we ingest on a daily basis, our drinking water.
And Emily, before... go ahead.
Oh, if I could just jump in, you know, I just wanted to mention that there's actually a hearing going on as we speak in Congress where the financial emergency manager Early is testifying before one of the House Oversight Committees. And, you know, I think it's important as we talk about all the problems we face for people to understand that when the Flint drinking water source was switched to the Flint River, that the city was under an emergency financial manager who had been appointed by Governor Snyder, and that, you know, that this is that we have issues of democracy as well as all these other issues that are at play here. And so I think, you know, I think it's important that he's testifying before Congress today. I think it's important that on Thursday, Governor Snyder, along with EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy, will be testifying before this oversight committee as well. And this is the first time that Governor Snyder will be testifying before Congress about his involvement in this whole crisis. And that members of Congress are, I think, keenly tracking what's going on and wanting to understand and get to the bottom of what happened here. And obviously, there's a lot that's at stake in whether or not a major funding package is going to end up passing through Congress. But I know at Food and Water Watch, we've been calling on Congress to step up and provide the funding that's needed to, you know, begin to immediately replace the lead pipes in Flint. And that, you know, it's very important that everyone who is accountable, including Governor Snyder, for this crisis is held accountable as well.
And Emily, before we let you go, are there any California politicians people should reach out to?
Well, you know, you can reach out to Jerry Brown about the issues with fracking in the state, of course. You know, that's a major campaign that we're working on there at Food and Water Watch. And again, you know, the oil and gas industry is exempt from these key provisions of the Safe Drinking Water Act. And we know that, you know, there are issues that people are having with their water across the country, not to mention, of course, what's gone on at Porter Ranch there with the major air issues and the public health crisis that's followed that. So, yeah, call Governor Brown and ask him to ban fracking in California.
All right.
Emily, and I would add, too,
I just wanted to say goodbye to Emily. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Emily Wirth is Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director. Sorry about that, Paul. We're just getting one more guest on the line, but go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I would just say that the U.S. EPA is going to be finalizing the rule that oversees lead and water called the Lead and Copper Rule over the next year and a half. And calling and writing and emailing and using social media to Barbara Boxer, our U.S. Senator on the Environment and Public Works Committee, would be a really good thing to say, train your eyes on to strengthen, not weaken, the lead and copper rule that is the major law that protects people from lead in their drinking water. Right now, there's a recommendation in front of U.S. EPA that would weaken the transparency and accountability of water utilities and allow the really terrible practice of only replacing part of the water line, the lead service line, not the full lead service line, all across the country. And so that's something that your listeners could learn more about, this rulemaking on the lead and copper rule and how to make it stronger, not weaker. And Barbara Boxer is a key person, Senator Boxer, in oversight of this law.
What happens when she leaves the Senate?
Well, hopefully the people of California will elect a good replacement. That's in your hands there on the left coast. And people really need to remain vigilant. The chairman of the committee, Inhofe, is a climate denier. And we have a need in our elected bodies at the federal, state, and local level for people really to assert themselves around this issue of water. It's such a vital center for our spiritual, our cultural, and our physical safety and health.
Paul Schwartz is Clean Water Action's National Policy Coordinator, and now I would like to welcome Jennifer Clary, who is Program Associate with Clean Water Action. She does work in the Central Valley. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
So you, I understand, have said that because there's so much attention on the water crisis in Flint, you say it's also important to talk about the fact that a lot of people do not have access to clean water in California. And late last year, we did a show about how the drought was affecting people in East Porterville, where they didn't have any water. They had to use bottled water. Can you give us an update on what's happening there?
It's as to the best of my knowledge, East Porterville is in the same situation where they have water tanks in front of their homes and they have water delivered a couple of times a week. There's efforts to hook them up to the city of Porterville, but I'm not sure what the status of those efforts are. And wells continue to go dry in the Central Valley. I was talking to someone on the phone yesterday who works with communities, and she was working with a community in Kings County that had just lost their water supply over the weekend. But over and above that, you have the drought emergency where more than 3,000 wells have gone dry during the drought, but you also have ongoing contamination issues where you have people who haven't had safe drinking water from their tap for more than a decade.
A decade?
Yes.
What explains that?
Well, many of these are small systems. You know, California is a big state. We have 7,500 water systems, but only 10% of those serve 95% of the residents of the state. You have 2,300 systems that serve drinking water to residents that have less than 1,000 connections. And that means they're very small, and when they have problems, they can't afford to fix them. And about 600 of those systems, actually closer to 500 now, don't meet safe drinking water standards. The most common contaminants are arsenic, which is generally naturally occurring, and nitrate, which is caused mostly by agriculture.
Right. According to NRDC, California officials identify agriculture, including cows, as the major source of nitrate pollution in more than 100,000 square miles of polluted groundwater.
Well, I've never measured groundwater that way, but it's true. The state did commission a report that came out in 2012 that showed that in the Salinas Valley and Tulare Lake Basin, which are two very intensive agricultural regions, 50% of the population had been impacted either directly or through their pocketbook by nitrate contamination, and that nitrate contamination continues to increase. In some parts of the Salinas Valley, you know, when you get that baby lettuce, when you grow baby lettuce, you get to grow like six crops a year, and you apply nitrogen fertilizer every time you have that crop. And so in the Salinas Valley, you have contamination that is many times the safe drinking water standard.
We were just speaking with Emily Wirth of Food and Water Watch, and she was encouraging listeners to call Governor Jerry Brown to support a ban on fracking. What is happening at the state level to address these issues?
Well, I don't work on fracking. It's not...
Not on fracking. I just mean to address the issue of water safety.
Thank you. Well, I think a major thing that happened that just took effect last year was moving the drinking water program. I've been working with the drinking water program for more than a decade in California, and they suffered from benign neglect when they were in the Department of Public Health. And the governor finally agreed because they had so many problems, they received a notice of violation from US EPA. And so the drinking water program was moved to the State Water Board, and in the past year, the State Water Board has been working very hard to increase oversight, get more direct assistance to small communities that needed assistance, and really upgrade the program. What they found, though, is, and I think this is true both in EPA and in other states, is that there's a real shortage of staffing at the regulatory level, and they're asking for, I think, an additional 45 people to help oversee the drinking water program to be sure that they're properly protecting our drinking water.
And what are your thoughts, Paul, before we end, just about where this is going? Because now that the water crisis in Flint has really resulted in so much media attention on this issue. So it seems
right.
Go ahead, Paul.
I don't know. Am I talking?
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Sorry, Paul. So I think a couple of things are happening. One is I think water purveyors are very anxious to let it be known that they're doing everything they can, and they're presenting to people, they're going through their association, the American Water Works Association, to get some standards in place. And I think they're pushing forward with changes in some of their infrastructure. I would point out that here in the Bay Area, East Bay Mud was a leader in lead abatement many years ago. It's been a decade since they passed AB 1953, which changed the definition of lead-free, which actually at one point allowed like 0.25% lead or 8% lead, and they changed that so that new fixtures and anything that touches water has to have less than 0.25% of lead. And that's also been adopted at the national level. So I think we have the state improving its oversight. You have large water agencies improving their oversight. The next thing you want to do is take a look at those small communities and see where you can either assist them through something like a water user fee that would be like the universal lifeline for energy or telephone, create one for water for low-income communities that can't afford safe drinking water, and also maybe try to eliminate some of these small water systems by consolidating with larger systems.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we will definitely continue to follow this issue. Jennifer Clary is Program Associate for Clean Water Action, and Paul Schwartz is Clean Water Action's National Policy Coordinator. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye, Paul.
Bye, Jennifer.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with investigative journalist Sally Denton about her new book, The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. From 1999 to 2013, Bechtel, the world's largest contractor, received $40 billion in contracts from the U.S. Departments of Energy and Defense. Denton says, despite its fiercely anti-regulatory, anti-government worldview, the Bechtel family owes its entire fortune to the U.S. government. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.